the Development Policy Centre podcast. In this episode, we bring you the recording of a recent lecture by Dr. Albert Schramm, who is the Vice Chancellor of PNG's University of Technology. He spoke on higher education reform in PNG.
All right, well, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for coming to this public seminar. And let's begin by acknowledging and celebrating the first Australians on whose traditional lands we meet, and by paying our respects to the elders of the Ngunnawal people, past and present. My name is Stephen Howes, and I'm the Director of the Development Policy Centre, and together with the Pacific Institute, and with support from the Australian Aid Program through the Pacific Governance and Leadership Precinct, we're very happy to bring you this event. In fact, it was meant to be a double header, as you probably know, and we're also going to hear from the Chancellor of UNITEC, Sir Ngora Bogan. But unfortunately, he had to cancel at the last minute, so we'll hope to have him host him another time. But we're still very fortunate to have Dr. Albert Schramm. So welcome, Albert. Dr. Schramm is the Vice-Chancellor of Papua New Guinea's University of Technology, and he is here today with Dr. Ora Ranagi, who is the Deputy Vice-Chancellor, I think, and Pauline Van Helden, his partner. So welcome to you all. Thank you very much for coming. In fact, I invited Albert to give us a talk long before the student protests broke out, but I guess it is a particularly sort of relevant or apt time to hear from him. I'm sure he really needs no introduction, but he's been Vice-Chancellor at UNITEC since 2012 and has a Doctorate in Economic History from the European University Institute and has research interests in economic history, among other things, and we have a common sort of heritage at the common home at the London School of Economics, I was pleased to discover. So, very warm welcome to a somewhat cold Canberra and to all of you. We look forward to hearing from you, Dr. Schramm, on University Reform in PNG, the UNITEC experience, and I'm sure there'll be lots of questions. So please welcome.
Thank you, Sian, for this kind introduction. It's great to be here, and it's really an honour to see you here in this centre of learning, and I'm really looking forward to questions and answer session. Therefore, I will keep it short. I only have 10 slides. I will talk about the wider reform in the higher education system and the things we have been doing and are planning to do at UNITEC. I guess you want to know a lot about the politics. I'm not an expert in that field. My association with PNG is rather short, but quite intense. So this is my fourth boycott as a Vice-Chancellor. Sometimes I think I should start a consulting practice helping other Vice-Chancellors dealing with boycotts. Staff strikes, not yet, so that is hopefully an area I will not have to explore. I will talk about university reform and the current challenges. I believe at this university, about a year ago, Minister Tabar came and he spoke about university reform quite extensively. It was then still work in progress. Today, I maintain that this reform has failed, so that we need to think of ways of getting it going again, because the needs are still there. Secondly, I'll say of what we have been doing at Papua New Guinea University of Technology, and finally, I want to sketch some opportunities for collaboration of partnerships, because I will suggest that instead of looking at a system approach at all the universities in Papua New Guinea, it's probably more productive to look at them individually and see how we can partner up. Higher education is, of course, a very international area, and we are no exception to that. The university was founded almost 51 years ago by Australia, and is located in Lae. I think most of you will know that that is the second biggest town in Papua New Guinea. At independence in 1975, the university had, I think, less than 1,000 students. Currently, we have 3,000 students, about 200 faculty members, of which 50 are foreigners. And we have a whole army of 950 support staff members, which is way too many. The minister inherited, Minister Tabar inherited a process of reform, and then which was the revision of the Higher Education Act, which has been more than 10 years in the making, and also the recommendations of a independent review of the university system. What came out of that reform process at the end of 2014 was a very limited result, which was mainly concerned with establishing political control of the universities. And now, after a year and a half or so, it is quite clear that universities want none of it. It focuses, of course, on the appointments of the chancellor, pro-chancellor, and vice-chancellor. But the fear is that this may extend also to deans and professors and directors. It doesn't open directly a way of having the what we call the donkey nephews of the ministers admitted to university. But of course, with political control over the management of the university, you get that. I remember from the former chancellor receiving faxes of him urging me to admit students from his tribe. And, you know, I could just throw these faxes into the waste basket. But if you are appointed by the government, that is much more difficult. So there is a severe risk that this will end the autonomies of council. Currently, the universities are statutory bodies created by an act. And in the legal system, of course, every act has the same validity. So we have a high degree of independence, which we inherited through Australia from the British system. And the councils would like to keep it that way. The fear, of course, is that the political instability in Papua New Guinea will be imported into the university councils, and that would really help nobody. At the end of my talk, I'll show you a short video of the master plan, for instance, that we developed for the university. That is a process that will take decades. If every couple of years you have a different chancellor, that process can be severely constrained, I think. And of course, if your council is no longer independent, you get threats to academic freedom as well. Our governance structure is a structure of what's called dual governance. So the academic board has a autonomous status and is the highest decision-making body in all academic matters. So it is not an advisory body to the council, it is a separate body. And the main task of the vice-chancellor is actually to find a balance between the academic board and the university council. And in the PNG system, the vice-chancellor chairs the academic board. So we don't have the independent chair of the academic board like many Australian universities. That came afterwards. So, the rationale for higher education reform has been and still is that there is a need to increase the capacity, the intake of students. The gross enrollment ratio in higher education now is less than 2%, and that's very low. The average for Africa is about 60%, India went from, I think, 10% a couple of decades ago to 40%. China has created 10 million university places in a decade. It's basically one new university a week. In PNG, the gross enrollment ratio now is lower than before independence. So it is, of course, the population has grown and the number of high school leavers have grown. Those who finish grade 12 in Papua New Guinea is also only 3% of those who start in grade 1. So the major attrition is happening in the primary and secondary school system. Then in the selection of students, now with the free education policies, these numbers are going up. So there's only place for about 20% of the students in the PNG higher education system. And that is an average which is skewed favorably towards the cities. But in rural areas, of course, this percentage is much lower. So these are grade 12 school leavers who sometimes have excellent grades but cannot find a place in the tertiary system. Another concern was the perceived lack of quality in our teaching and competences of our graduates. This is, of course, the complaints from the employers. That is an issue that also needs to be addressed. Because of a number of reasons in the 80s and 90s, basically the knowledge base of university was destroyed. Some of those were macroeconomic shocks, but there were also some misguided measures of reducing the allowances of foreign professors and so on. So my predecessor said that, you know, that was one of the biggest mistakes he ever made to allow that to happen. And then he worked long and hard to rebuild the knowledge base of university, but that takes so much time. So that is a challenge. Then in the terms of operations, there is the councils are not holding the management accountable. I hope soon to be the first vice chancellor ever in Papua New Guinea to have a performance review done by council. And accountability, of course, comes from the top down. So if the vice chancellor is not accountable, he cannot hold the heads of departments and the deans accountable, and so on and so forth. So that is a simple innovation that we can do. But of course, the main problem has been the lack of financial accountability. So external audits were always done at the universities. They would go to Parliament, and they were always terrible. And the councils did nothing to address this issue. And that is what I saw as one of the biggest problems, because by not being accountable, nobody can help you, nobody can give you funds. So, for instance, University of South Pacific, where they don't have biannual or annual boycotts, and where they are accountable, they basically double their budget through sources from, you know, companies and foreign aid. So when I saw that campus, I said, well, that's what we could do as well if we get our reports in order. And finally, there's been practically no infrastructure development on the campus more than 40 years. The state of Papua New Guinea has funded one dormitory, and that was it. So we have some new buildings. One was the most beautiful one, actually, of the Department of Forestry, was generously donated by Australia. And then there are four buildings donated by the European Union. But on the whole, the campus just looks the same as when it was built in 1969. So the challenges for the universities, it was felt that they had to be addressed by a comprehensive reform or in the legal framework. but also in the governance of the universities. So this this independent review of the PNG university system was done was agreed upon by the Somare and Rudd governments in 2010, and the main authors there were from the PNG side, Namaliu, and then Roscano from the Australian side. The vice chancellors were asked to comment on this review, and these comments then were integrated into a document and adopted as government policy in June 2012, and I believe subsequently forgotten. The two major points in this review were first that the councils needed to be reformed. They were based mostly on a principle of representation. So we have a council of 32 members. Two are members of parliament who fortunately never show up, because then the meetings would last probably much longer. Then we have 8 government-appointed members. We have 6 council-appointed members. And then we have about 16 or so staff members who represent different sections of the staff. The whole Vice-Chancellor's office is member of the council. So it is it's quite difficult to chair a big meeting like that. And for that reason, the council has 16 committees where actually the decisions are being taken. So it is it's quite a top-heavy structure, but with good chairmanship and good support, the structure can work. And I think that is what we saw when the new chancellor was appointed, who is a very capable chairman and doesn't put up with a lot of nonsense. So the meetings, they don't last too long, but not too short either, and the agenda is being discussed. The second conclusion of the Namaliu Gano report was that academic quality issues needed to be addressed, the curriculum needs to be updated, fully qualified academics needed to be hired, and so on and so forth. So those challenges, I think, are still there with us today. Some universities now have reformed their councils, but the two big ones have not. And there's still a lot of internal debate on how to do that and what we actually want to achieve. As I said, the reform also was a update of the Higher Education Act. The Papua New Guinea, like other countries in the Pacific, they didn't have a real Department of Higher Education. They had an Office of Higher Education with a Commission of Higher Education, which would do the policy part. Because they were never very helpful, I called them the Office Against Higher Education, but that is not the official name. So now the new Higher Education Act establishes a department and then a separate secretariat for research and something else. So last year in the budget, I think they tried to appropriate more than 100 million kina for that. The civil servants, they need their buildings and their vehicles and their salaries. And when I hear 100 million kina, I say I can run 2 universities for that. But so the government has been doing a cost-cutting exercise. So they took all that money away. So the Department of Higher Education really exists only on paper. And it's still the old Office of Higher Education, but and then with a new name. For the universities, it was very telling what this whole exercise of revision of the Higher Education Act meant, because the only consequential amendments in our Act were about the appointments of the Chancellor, Pro-Chancellor and the Vice-Chancellor. So here you see clearly that the main concern was not governance, was not academic quality, it was political control. So very undiplomatically, when the new minister visited our campus, I welcomed him with a strong critique of Article 109. It was in October 2014. So that took some time to percolate, but eventually there was a meeting with all the chancellors and all the vice chancellors, who were all equally unhappy with this Article 109 and some other things. So the minister promised a process of consultation that may have taken place in his mind, but it was not really a physical process where people talk to each other. So that the article, the Higher Education Act, is now law. We're supposed to implement these amendments, but we haven't done so, and we kind of, you know, playing for time and hoping that it will all go away. One of the reasons legally is that Article 9 mentions some regulations, and those regulations have never been finalized. Again, they exist maybe in somebody's mind, but they don't really exist. So that makes it, it's very difficult to implement a law when the regulations on which the implementation of the law depends do not exist. So a very messy process. The vice chancellors and others felt particularly ambushed, because in 2013, I was not there at the moment, but they were consulted about a text of the Higher Education Act, but that was a completely different text as the one that went to Parliament. So everybody generously offered and wasted their time, and then was surprised with this monstrous act. The idea was to have the Chancellor and Pro-Chancellor directly appointed by NEC, and then the Vice-Chancellor's appointment had to be approved. In my interpretation, governments in developing countries find it very difficult to understand that although they have to pay most of the bills, they cannot appoint the vice-chancellor and the chancellor and so on. So that is a conversation that has to take place. But if there is no willing ears to listen, then it becomes quite difficult to do anything about that. We kind of ignore this process. Personally, I take the view that, you know, I was hired to run the university, and I gladly leave the politics to the Chancellor and the Deputy Vice-Chancellor as well. So I kind of, get out of the way. But it is, in a term of, the future of the higher education system, quite worrying that this tradition of university autonomy and academic freedom and council autonomy can be just eliminated by a few bureaucrats and a lawyer who don't consult with anybody, and bring it to Parliament. And as you probably know, Parliament in Papua New Guinea has very little support. There's hardly a good library. There are no research assistants, and parliamentarians don't tend to know much about higher education, so they'll just vote along party lines, and I think this was voted 49-0 or something like that. So it was just hammered through, and now we are stuck with the problem. So, hopefully in the next parliamentary session we can either amend the act or propose a completely new act. That is up to the political system. All right, so the second section is then more concretely about UNITEC. It is one of these universities of technologies which were created all over the Commonwealth according to a very similar model. It was originally part of UPNG. We found it by the same act. But then in the House of Assembly there was a strong lobby group from Eastern Britain, which at the time was the better educated part of Papua New Guinea, And they said, we also want a university for the Nungini Islands, and that has to be located in Leh. So the Institute of Technology, as it was called then, was split off from UPNG and given a very large campus north of Leh. It's about 220 hectares. At the time, Paul Hasluck was the Minister of the Territories, and he was one of the driving forces also behind the creation of the campus. And although he was already Governor General of Australia in June 1969, he came over to open the campus, our campus, personally. So that is, part of Australian and now Papua New Guinean history. One of the pressure points that we saw that needed to be changed quickly was that we had a University of Technology without much technology. An ICT building had been built, that was the European Union's donation. But we had internet through a VSAT system, which is not appropriate for a large university. In 2013, a fiber cable came live to Leh, but the connection with the main cable was through Madang. So we have two risks of failure. One is the main cable and the other one is the connection from Leh to Madang. So our connection was much worse than it is in Port Moresby. And then in 2015, Telecom also managed to shut us off for 3 months. The CEO came later after 3 months with a little hand scribbled note and said, this is how you have to fix it. I said, well, it's too late. You're no longer our provider, main provider. We went with O3B, which is means the other 3 billion. It is an international company based in The Hague, but with investments from Google and India and so on. And they run a satellite network of low-orbit satellites, about 8,000 kilometers, which means that the signal travels much quicker than the VSAT satellites, which are at 40,000 kilometers. So you basically have the same latency or speed as you have with fiber, but then through satellite. So that allows us to, use complicated sites, book our own travel, have video conferences, and so on and so forth. So on the 1st of July 2015, we switched on the L3B installation, and suddenly there was internet. That was quite an experience. But of course, in that way, we had missed out on 20 years of using internet. So our staff who had been there had not developed any skills. They can do a bit of email. They still believe that email is a great way of writing funny messages to each other or insult people they don't like. They use it for everything, but that's about the only thing they know how to use. So there's a process of catching up for the faculty and staff. For the students, of course, that is different. They really have much more in common with Australian and European students than with their own parents, for example. They're millennials. They've always had a cell phone. And they've always used the internet. And they adopt things very, very quickly. So our council allowed us to buy laptops for all the first-year students. We buy them in Malaysia, wholesale. Big problem. It's $1 billion. Takes us a long time to pay that, but with the currency rationing. But I think last week the first shipment finally came in, a few months late, but better late than never. These laptops come without Windows and without viruses. They come pre-installed with Ubuntu. In developing countries, you cannot afford licenses, and you have a huge virus problem. The universities have been running 2 years without virus protection. So you can imagine that every machine is infested. Now, by running another operating system which doesn't have viruses, we can be much, much safer. The second, I think, so there was a big effort from our council to to upgrade the ICT. Another decision that was taken, which was actually part of the Namayuga No process, was to strive for international accreditation. So we set up an industrial advisory board with very high-level executives from the main large companies in Papua New Guinea. It's chaired by ExxonMobil, who are also one of the biggest supporters for this process. Currently, they support us only in kind and in staff time because our accounts are still not in order. But they're helping us to sort out our finances and become more efficient. And once we have that reached that milestone, they can actually help us with some funding. Another thing they sponsor is the external assessor system. So each subject now has to have a subject file, and which are revised by an internal academic quality team. But once a year, external assessors come and give us a report card on where we stand. I was very happy to see that at our last council meeting, about 80% of the subjects already had a subject file. So the faculty is really willing to work with us, although they sometimes don't know what they are supposed to do and so on and so forth, but we support them. But the first step is taken. Then we don't have a problem with understaffing in the faculty. By the way, nobody has tenure, which is a dream for a vice chancellor. All the academics have to behave reasonably well, otherwise their contracts are not renewed and they can't sue us because we're not obliged to renew it. Of course, you know, we need them, so there is a kind of a balance there. We have 200 faculty, 3,000 students. That's a 1 in 15 ratio. That's actually quite good. The problem is the level of the faculty. They're not fully qualified. They don't have doctorates. And that is a accreditation requirement that about 80% should have a doctorate. So we increased the number of people we send abroad to do higher degrees from about 2 or 3 per year, which was mainly sponsored by Australia and New Zealand, to about 10 per year, where we also send people to India, Korea, and Japan, and so on. Then we have increased the number of scholarships applications that we do and grant applications. So we always get a scholarship from the Association of Commonwealth Universities, but we have been looking for support from the European Commission through Erasmus Mundus, Horizon 2020, and then a number of bilateral agreements with these countries. We also invest ourselves. With some universities, we have a kind of a handshake agreement that we try to send, or we allow them to select our two best students, and then they pursue their master's or doctorate degree. So one of them is the QUT in Brisbane that we have had a long relation with, and also a new IIT in India, in near Ahmedabad. So we hope that those students eventually will come back. But most of all, we hope they get their PhD quickly. Because in the old system, we would get people back with a PhD for about 45 or 50 years old, and that is too old. So we want them, you know, 35, 40, so that they have another 10 good years to go, then we can make them professors, and they have a nice career. We're currently trying to organize dual degree programs for masters. All our departments have an internal master's degree now, but it's not always the quality that we would like it to be. So we believe that's probably more cost effective to have people do their master's degree in country and doctorate degree then abroad. So to round up this section, the higher education reform and all the issues around governance, we have really a good governance system. A a few weeks ago, the chancellor at UPNG actually said, it's like we were given a Rolls Royce at Independence, and it needs to be, brushed up a bit and modernized. But now you're asking us to drive around in a second-hand car. We don't want that. And I think that's right. In fact, the Secretary of the Department of Higher Education, who's also a council member, both of UPNG and Unitec, he came with an Australian consultant and telling the council that the chancellor had to be appointed by the government and the pro-chancellor as well. I think Dr. Nagy was in the session in November when in UPNG they got a more than frosty reception, I would say. And we had a repeat act in March, April now in both councils, and UPNG went from openly hostile to very frosty. So they don't want any of that. And I told the consultant, I said, listen, if you had the guts to come into an Australian council and say that, they would have booted you out of the room. So I pointed out also to the High Commissioner that there's a significant political risk in undertaking these type of things, and that he'd better give the money to the universities than to the Department of Higher Education, which is pursuing such a narrow and such a selfish agenda. So, we rather focus on more important things. So we still have a very bloated payroll. So we are looking at a major reorganization. There's a lot of wastage still in terms of utilities, water and power. We have to focus on our teaching quality, international accreditation. Like all universities, we want more research. We need to adapt our infrastructure, get Wi-Fi going on the campus. We want to set up an entrepreneurship program, innovation center. And we're using internationalization as a kind of leverage to push through these changes. So what are the opportunities for partnerships? We are supporting our faculty both in their teaching and in their research skills. So we set up what we call postgraduate certificates. This is developed in-house, delivered in-house. But with some external support, I think it would be, much better and much more impact. We've already started the student-centered teaching postgraduate certificate. It's been very well received. So we'll do that every semester with small groups of faculty members. One trick we use there is that some of them, they lack a few years of teaching experience for their next promotion. So we're going to introduce an equivalence that if they get the certificate, that is good for 3 years or 4 years of teaching experience, so then they can actually be promoted quicker. So that makes it easier for people from professional areas or industry to get them up to a good level. We have opportunities for partnerships in numerous areas. With ANU, we had a partnership for development studies in the undergraduate. That could be extended possibly to the masters. We need a lot of help in accounting. It's one of our biggest sections. But the accounting education really has to go up to a better standard. Economics has practically died down. With Professor Howes, we've talked about it, that there are very few competent economists in Papua New Guinea. And you've done wonderful work at UPNG to get the economics education up. But we also have an economics section, which I think should be more applied and more business-oriented than UPNG. But there's definitely a need there. We have a mining engineering department, the only one in the Pacific. The interesting aspect of this is that this department has no foreign faculty members. It's all nationals. I think there's now four or five with a PhD. Then we have an applied physics department, which is also quite unique. Dr. Nagy, now the deputy vice chancellor, was the head of that department. And one of the challenges they're looking for is to create a biomedical engineering department. So they are, you know, experts in all kinds of instrumentation. And the health system in Papua New Guinea needs people who can, you know, engineer the equipment that is that's necessary for the treatment. Then finally, in the operations, we also need a lot of support. The introduction of new IT that's not happened over the last 20 years. HR, reorganization. Now we have one staff member who knows has a degree in HR. She's been sick for a while or absent, so that means nothing happens. With you know consultants, you can get a lot of things moving, and we do, but we really need a lot more than we can afford at the moment. And the same for financial accounting and reporting, which is such a strategic issue. Fortunately, we have a very experienced financial consultant, and he has helped us get through last year and make some you know submissions. He found that you know we had forgotten to claim 2.5 million, I think, and with Deputy Vice Chancellor they went to Moresby and we got our 2.5 million back. So the consultant was worth the investment. Final remarks. So I believe that after a very long crisis, which actually started in 2007 before I came, with a massive strike and student boycott. In 2007, our current chancellor, Sir Nagora, was appointed chancellor already, but he was only chancellor for one day because the incumbents took out a court order and were hiding behind that court order to stay there glued to their seats. I accelerated that process a bit and got them unstuck from their seats. And in 2014, we had this unique opportunity where we started with a brand new council and a brand new management team and a university that was, you know, willing and able to move forward. And that is really what keeps me going because, you know, universities are very conservative institutions. They don't want to go anywhere and all the professors, you know, they care about their brand, which is their first name and their last name. They're usually not very cooperative or, you know. We have this opportunity to get the organization, to rebuild the organization and get it moving and become a good university. And a few days ago, I said also that there's really no reason why a, you know, admittedly poorly funded university in a developing country cannot just be a good university. Yeah, and good in terms that we do what we say we're doing. We give a level, we set a standard and try to deliver up to that standard. It is not a matter of money. It's a matter of competence and organization. And then, you'll have to live within the means. So I think we are ready for an increased engagement with outside partners in all our main activities, operation, teaching, research, and of course outreach. Industry has been our biggest supporter the last years, particularly ExxonMobil, but also others. And we hope that we can get some support from outside because, you know, we really need all the help we can get, and we don't get it from our own state, which is just pursuing this interest of gaining control over our council. Then I'll close on a forward-looking note. For the last 2 years, we have been developing a master plan for our campus, and you know, despite our current challenges, we like to dream big, and we believe that if we can get the investors on board and we follow the right strategy, we can really develop our campus into something nice and beautiful. So here is a short news broadcast. You also see some of the old buildings and some bit of the campus as it is now. This is my office here. It looks a bit like a settlement, but we blend into our environment here.
PNTEC solely relies on government funding for its operations. Its growth heavily relies on how much money the government allocates annually. This year, the university was asked by the National Executive Council to cut back on funding. The PNG University of Technology's administration is developing a plan to use available campus land to develop a township that will have shops, banks, business activities that will generate revenue for UNITEC's long-term operations.
That, in the case of Lae, at the moment there's no modern major shopping centres, whereas in Port Moresby there's four now, with Vision City, Wagani Central, the two on the waterfront. So there's the potential for a centre of that nature to be developed on the university campus, with cinemas, with grocery and so on. So this is what we see as the opportunity for UNITEC in the northern part of Lae.
Paul Walters, the director of Atlas Urban Design and Strategy, has worked on a plan for UNITEC, and he says the master plan is designed in a way that will suit interested organizations in all sectors to invest into the area.
Business houses and technology companies, as well as retail, so supermarkets and groceries could also be part of the town centre. A new market is also being planned as part of the master plan. So this is done in a way that invites private investment, that invites business houses to invest in the university campus.
The plan was presented last week Friday to key players in the private sector and also top-ranking bureaucrats at a dinner hosted by Vice-Chancellor Dr. Albert Schramm.
Now, the development will happen in components where interested parties will invest money over time to have infrastructure built.
The aim now is to gather momentum behind a plan that will bring revenue to the university and help it develop as well as sustain itself into the future. Bethany Harriman, National Lab TV News, Lae.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. That was really fascinating. Questions?
Thanks. Could you tell us a bit more about the bloated payrolls, please? You didn't go into much detail.
it's an issue that a lot of state agencies have. In our case, we have an establishment, I think, in a support staff of about 500 or 550, and we have 960 people on contracted. So these are called unattached officers. So on the 4th of February this year, the Department of Treasury instructed us to make a plan to get rid of these unattached officers. So I said, well, that's a great opportunity because we can reorganize, and the Vice Chancellor doesn't get the blame, but we can blame the Department of Treasury. But yeah, it's of course a product of the One Talk system, where a job at university is given to some friends. All universities do that a little bit. There is the case of the spousal hiring of professors, for instance. That is, happens in all universities. But what's different in PNG is that these ladies who can maybe operate at the level of a secretary or assistant accountant, then they're kind of slowly promoted because of their status socially. And that's where the problems begin, because then they are operating at two or three levels above their competence. And so I have nothing against swan talks, I have nothing against spouses, as long as they're competent. And that is what has been missing. Yeah.
I'd like to ask from the point of view of universities as statutory bodies, and you use this phrase, no willingness to listen to the appointment of council members, the chancellor and the pro-chancellor.
Yeah.
So in the composition of the council, is there an overseas or outside member in the councils that the universities have? Because
yes.
In the past, We used to have a representative from Australia who would be a member of the council. And I suppose from that membership there would be this independent view, and also maybe, I mean, I'm trying to get to your bridge to communicate with the politicians, the people who make the powers. And it seems to me that, you know, it's going to be a long battle, that, you know, we have to somehow think of whispering into those politicians we know will listen and bring about change.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it is very important you're laying the foundation to move forward, but it can't happen without the political will or the influence of the people who make those decisions to finance you. So,
yeah.
You know, I would like to know if there is outside representation in the council, you know, an Australian, New Zealander, or whoever.
Yeah.
And what influence they have.
No, at the moment it is not in our act, but I think in the Namayu Kanao report there is some text about, you know, desirability of having a foreign council member. We have six council-appointed members, so those are based on their expertise. We choose one lawyer, one accountant. We prefer people from the private sector and people who are based in Lae. You know, running a big council like that, even a small council meeting easily costs $5,000. So it is a major cost. So we want to keep the cost down. The way the Act now is written, and there's a lot of wisdom in that, it's based on this principle of representation, which is, I think, a very culturally appropriate principle in Papua New Guinea, where, you know, all groups have a say and have listening ears in the council. The proposal at UPNG, which was kind of consensus at the time, was that we should keep that principle of representation and have a balanced council, but basically reduce the membership somewhat. So instead of having, you know, four or five members of the Vice Chancellor's office, maybe two is enough. And instead of having two professors, maybe we could have one, and so on and so forth. So if you do that exercise and then you forget about the parliamentarians, you end up with a council of maybe 16 or 17, which is quite manageable. So you can deal with the council size issue, but still respect the principle of representation. If you go to a purely external or expertise-based council, well, there are two views of that. The Minister of Public Enterprise believes that all the CEOs of public enterprises should be our council. But that, of course, means a completely politicized council, because those are not private enterprises, those are state enterprises. So, you know, this idea of having a completely independent council with outsiders, which is kind of a corporate model. Personally, I don't think in Papua New Guinea that would work very well. I would be the only staff member in that council, and I would continuously hit this wall of CEOs who don't really understand that the university has a dual governance structure, that I have to deal with an academic board as well. That we have a shared governance tradition. So all these opinionated and stubborn professors, you have to put them all in a committee, make them part of the decision-making process, otherwise they're going to be against you. I think that would be really an impoverishment. We have these people now. You know, the CEO of Tukai is in our... but he's wise enough not to talk about university typical university matters, but more about the finances in the reorganization. And there his input is more than welcome. But if I would have, 13 of these fellows, I think I would get a very tough time. Yeah.
Thank you.
Colin.
How do you deal with the prospect of the national government failing to deliver funds promised in the annual budget? How do you insure yourself against that?
Well, that's a tough one. Last year in June, the Department of Treasury threatened all state agencies to withhold 40% of their annual budget. So the vice chancellors, you know, frankly, they panicked. We panicked. We had a. They flew over to Moresby. We had a emergency meeting in the Department of Treasury, and nobody from Treasury showed up. So we immediately planned another emergency meeting. But in the end, their threat, they didn't follow through on it. So our council, we discussed it in council twice, and you know our council is they. You know, they are visitors. They are your best and cheapest consultants, but they don't have an executive role. They don't have to do anything really. But of course, they want to help you. So they said, "Yeah, we'll have a delegation and we'll go to the Prime Minister." Okay. The next council member says, next meeting, the same story. We'll have a delegation and we go to the Prime Minister. And then I looked at Chancellor, and Chancellor looked at me and said, "Well, I can't solve the problem." So anyway, at the end of the meeting, we had our student representative, who's 21 years old, and he was sitting there with his reverse cap and his can of Coke, and he said, "Hey, Rishi, you want to see James Marape? He's a friend of mine." I said, "Yeah, that would be nice." So the next day, we had after a few days, we had breakfast with James Marape, and of course, there was a lot of whinging and whining that there was no money and this and that. But he gave us a verbal assurance that he would keep the universities afloat. In fact, he is personally involved in, let's say, a charm initiative with the various SRCs in the country to make sure that they listen to the government. So that has a downside, but it also has a plus side because it gives you access. And we've been lucky that, we've had three SRC presidents from the Southern Highlands, of course, but they were also smart. And UPNG has been unlucky because they've had two stupid ones, and now they come up with this Engen, who is very smart, but is, of course, a hothead. And right in the... Yeah, maybe. Yeah. Yeah, well, Don Polio has changed a bit. We saw him at the airport, and I said, "Don Polio, I think you were always right about this UBS loan. The only thing you have to do now is to wait." And he was very, grinning and said, "Yeah, I'll wait. Yeah. Anyway, it is it's a small world at PNG, but so this year we've been kind of groomed now into the stress. So a few weeks ago, we got a letter from the IRC, and our bursar came, and he came first to Deputy Vice Chancellor. "Oh, we have a 40 million debt and we have to pay in 2 weeks, otherwise we get a fine of 20%. So he started to laugh, and then he walked into my office. He gave me the letter, and I also started to laugh. The bursar is new. So he said, no. I said, "Don't take this so seriously." So, okay. But that is what they do. I mean, they really ran out of money in December 2014. And we have seen our grants come, delayed, incomplete. But we also know that the government understands they have to keep us afloat. So that's what they do. So we are afloat, barely. Yeah. And this year, we don't know. I mean, there is a real risk that the country will default. And when that happens, the Kina will probably nosedive. For us, we have two bills in dollars only. That is once a year for the laptops for the students, and then every month for our internet provider. So that will become more difficult to pay. But companies like Puma or Trukai, they have a 15, $20 million bill per month that they have to pay, and they're not paying it. They're just getting it on credit and through their foreign partners. So that is a real issue for them. So now in Cairns, there was a lot of muscular talk about the fundamental health of the economy. I remember Alan Greenspan saying something about that before the global financial crisis. So, you know, I had a feeling that we were dancing to the tunes of the orchestra on the Titanic just before it was sinking.
On that cheerful note, any more questions, any comments? Yeah.
Earlier on, while we were starting to make a few holes in that feast outside, we were talking about the student strikes and so on. You made some comments about the situation in Lae compared to Moresby. Can you say them to the wider group?
Yeah, of course. Well, you know, as I said, I don't know much about UPNG because I go to the council meeting once a year, and FDU Vice Chancellor also goes a couple of times a year. But for our students, we see a big change in their behavior and in their attitudes from 2012. In 2012, they were still quite wild. And they would use a kind of a traditional, model of throwing stones and setting things on fire. And that was not very nice. But during that boycott, I was kind of, left alone. So I invented something which I first called the Vice Chancellor's Committee or something. But I basically got the staff organizations and the students together, and I would ask them what their ideas were. And so we have institutionalized that. So we have a monthly management forum on the last Friday of the month. And then the staff organizations come, they report on their discussions in the organizations and salary matters, and we try to deal with some of their questions straight away, but others we have to deal with it later. And then we usually finish with the concerns of the students. And sometimes we also invite our neighbors from the settlement who have a lot of issues of their own, and they kind of feel bad that a tiny minority of them causes a lot of problems in terms of theft and destruction and hold-ups and so on. So that is a mechanism that we created to, get the trust of the students. Then I also have an open door policy. So HODs are always welcome between 8 and 9 in the morning, students between 4 and 5. And I encourage them to come before things become, start to be a very large problem. And the other members of the management team, they understand that, and they have a similar approach. And it really works. Sometimes they just want to be heard. That's all. And we're really a small university. It's only 3,000 students. If the vice chancellor can do this, so let's do it. Of course, the first boycotts were about the council matters, so we were more kind of drawn into that. Today, this week, the issue is not with us, and we had prepared this mission to Australia this week and paid all the trips and stuff. So we said, no, let's just do it, and the registrar and the PVC, the two PVCs are there to take care of the business, and they're doing quite well. Another change we saw that was in 2012, I would never see female students. They would not come up to me. I would use my wife, Paulina, to search them out and listen to them. And now they come up to my office, but also to Dr. Nagy's office. They have a female students association, which was created last year by one of your applied physics students. She got the leadership prize this year, creating something new. And there's actually also a female treasurer this year. So our SSC is there is a male president and a male vice president, and both are very They're both very soft-spoken personalities and very easygoing. And then there's two females who are actually the ones who talk with the management. So we see a huge change. And you know, with our chancellor, we and myself, we are kind of actively promoting the bigger role of females in all bodies of the university. Including our management team, we have still a vacancy for one PVC, but I would really like it to be a female. We only have a female registrar now, and in each team, if you have only one female, that's not good for the dynamics. I would like to have at least two. This one is very special. She's the most experienced of the lot, and she regularly runs circles around us, so she makes us feel a bit silly, but that's good. But the students, as well, they're getting more confident. And again, you know, if from the top level, you know, the chancellor gives these messages, I give these messages, then they see what we do. So it really has an effect on the students. But again, you know, another change there is now that in the old days, SSC was like a kind of a student government and there was nothing under it. But since 2013, it has become a coalition. So when I came, the previous vice chancellor had outlawed all the provincial groupings. And because you have to be Papua New Guineans and nationals and so on, I said, well, you know, there's all these different languages, and I'm European. We have, 28 languages, or 28 states and 26 languages. And we, for practical reasons, we often organize in language groups and get the job done, and then we go to Brussels. So let's not outlaw them, but let's limit their scope to, let's say, cultural events, graduate nights. But then during the boycotts, they actually form a committee, which is their own innovation, doesn't exist on paper. So the committee is the presidents of all the provincial associations, plus, I think, the SOC. And that is their little, you know, parliament where they discuss their things. And then they still go to the big open forum to discuss matters. What happened in, so that was in 2013. What also happened in 2014 is that the SOC president made an explicit commitment to non-violent action. And that was, I think, very important, and we have encouraged that strongly. So then all the rock throwing and fire setting activities are really, you know, referred to the margins. The other story that I think is important, we also encourage a strong student leadership team who have a plan, who have a strategy, who organize themselves, and we facilitate that somehow. So, you know, we give them, you know, vehicles so they can go with a trainer for weekends to do their team building and their planning. And we would also like to see that at the national level. In fact, I organized an activity like that with the youth grant from AusAid in 2012. And promptly the pro-chancellor accused me of willing to overthrow the government with the students. I said, no, it's not that, but I believe in a strong student government because that keeps the radicals under control. In 2012, we had a scary situation that after 2 weeks of boycotts, the radicals became very impatient, and they filled the two vehicles full of diesel, and they were going to set fire to the port of Leh. So fortunately, the student president, the SSC president, was quite strong, so he personally stopped them, and he said, listen, if you do that, you're going to discredit our whole movement, because it has nothing to do with us. And you're probably going to get shot. So they turned back. But that is my fear, that a small group of radicals, you know, they become impatient and then, they do crazy things. So Yeah, we want a strong student leadership in our own interests.
The police aren't very geared to non-violent action. what's your liaison like with the police?
Maybe we'll... okay, just make that the last question.
Yeah, okay, so... No, I wouldn't say so. This year, the lay police was a very positive surprise. They have been working with the students and allowed them to do the demonstration, although the same demonstration in Moresby was not allowed. And we always tell the students to talk with the police in great detail to make sure that they just don't go out and confront them. The lay police has been wonderful, I would say. So that's very different. We have a very different dynamic from Port Moresby. Yeah.
Thanks. All right. Well, look, we are out of time. I'm sure you could come and talk with Vice Chancellor afterwards. I'm not sure whether there'll be any more food outside because there are students around. They normally vacuum up everything. But please have a look. In any case, please try. And thank you so much.
Been listening to a podcast from the Development Policy Centre. For more information on our work, visit our website at devpolicy.anu.edu.au. To join the conversation on Australian aid, Papua New Guinea and the Pacific, and global development policy, visit our blog at devpolicy.org. At the blog, you can also sign up to our newsletter for all the latest updates or connect with us on social media. Thanks for listening.